Okay, looks like it's going. You got it.
Okay. Hi, I'm Donna Norman of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, and today's date is March 16, 2010, and it's approximately 2:30 in the afternoon. And with me today is Victor Cunicelli of the FCIC. We're in the Washington, D.C. offices of the FCIC. And you want to introduce who's on your end, Susan?
Suzanne, sure. We're in two places. Okay. You have Susanna Bergel and Michael Berger from Paul Weiss. And Mimi, I'll go ahead and let you give your introduction.
Right, and it's Mickey Fatia and Mary Reeser from Citi.
Okay, and could you spell your name, please, for the tape recorder?
Sure, it's R-E-I-F-E-R-T.
Oh, I'm sorry, I meant Mr. Fatia.
Sure, it's my first, Mickey's last name is Fatia, it's B-S-Boy. H-A-T-S-N-T-O-I-A.
Okay. And Mr. Batia, with your consent, in lieu of a formal transcription or extensive note-taking today, we're tape recording your interview this afternoon. Do you consent to that tape recording?
Yes, I do.
Thank you. And Mr. Batia, are you represented by counsel today?
Yes, I am.
Okay. And could you just identify which individuals are representing you? The counsel can speak.
Sorry, that's Paul Weiss who's representing me.
Okay.
As well as in-house counsel.
Perfect. Okay. And is other than the folks that have identified themselves, are there any other individuals present on the call?
No.
And not at Paul Weiss.
Okay.
Right, and not at Citi.
If additional people join during the course of the interview, if you could just state their names and affiliations as they join, we would appreciate that. Okay.
Please.
And we'll do the same. Mr. Batia, the FCIC was established by statute, and it was signed into law by the president. It's a bipartisan commission of 10, and it's charged with examining the causes of the financial crisis and the collapse or near collapse of major domestic financial institutions. The commission is charged with composing a report of its findings to the President and Congress by December 15, 2010. Some of the things that we investigate will become public at some point. Our investigation, however, is confidential, and we ask that you keep the fact of and substance of today's conversation confidential as well.
Okay.
The commission can compel attendance and testimony of witnesses in the production of records, and your counsel can provide you a copy of the statute if it's helpful. For our purposes today, we need to let you know that the FCIC is an agency of the United States, and FCIC staff are federal employees under the U.S. Code and Section 1001 concerning false statements applies today. Consequently, it's a crime not to be truthful in your interview with us today. Is there any reason you can't tell the truth today?
No.
Perfect. A few housekeeping items. If a question is unclear, please ask and we'll clarify it. Please respond audibly. Since the interview has been conducted over the phone, we cannot see your gestures and your head nods. Additionally, if you could use yes and no rather than uh-huh and uh-huh, it'll be a little easier for us if we need to go back to the tape recording.
Sure.
Thank you. Today, we're going to focus on the securitization and CDO businesses of Citigroup and Citi entities. And we're trying to understand, in particular, the structuring, valuation, trading, risk, and risk management practices on the CDO desk at Citi. But before we dive into that, if you could answer a few background questions, just so Vic and I know who you are, that would help us. Could you briefly articulate your post-secondary education and employment? And
yes, I have a degree in radiology from that's a PhD in from MIT, but it's a joint program between MIT and Harvard. I graduated with my PhD in 1994, I joined J.P. Morgan in risk management in 1994. I worked there between 1994 and 2003 in a variety of roles. And then I left J.P. Morgan to join Deutsche Bank in 2003. I was there through 2006 when I was hired by Citigroup in London. And I've been with Citigroup since then.
When in 2006 did you join Citi?
I started around 1st of August 2006.
Okay. Did you come over with Michael Raines?
Yes, I did.
Okay. So did he also start in August?
He started, I believe, before that. I don't remember the exact date.
Okay.
I do remember when I joined Citi, he was already in place.
And what were you doing at Deutsche Bank?
I was co-head of a desk at Deutsche Bank, which was a trading desk. It was called Credit Correlation Trading. I was co-head of that desk with another colleague of mine at Deutsche. And I was brought over by Michael Raines to head up the same effort, to head the credit correlation trading desk at Citigroup.
At Deutsche Bank, did credit correlation include structuring CDOs?
It included structuring ABS. I believe your question is regarding the ABS CDOs.
It is.
At Deutsche Bank, there were two different businesses. There was an ABS CDO business, and there was also an ABS correlation business. None of the businesses were underneath me. That was a separate part of the desk.
I'm sorry. You were co-head of the trading desk at Credit Correlation?
Yes. We had separate, so Credit Correlation was separate from ABS Correlation.
I see. Okay.
I was not running that part of the business.
Okay. Prior to joining Citigroup, did you have experience directly in ABS CDOs?
No, I did not.
Okay. And I hope your counsel, Paul Weiss, has warned you that she promised us that somebody, and I believe that's you, would explain to us what the correlation desk does.
Unfortunately, Mr. Bhatia has been warned, but we also had to warn ourselves because, as I've explained to you, Donna, this is complicated. So
we'll try it this way and see how it works. Mr. Bhatia, you have much more education than I do, and I'm not a numbers person, but to the best of your ability, if you can explain what the correlation desk does to somebody that is not a securities trader, we'll see how
sure.
that goes.
I mean, let me start, and please obviously interrupt me and ask me questions. I'm going to compare, I think the best way to explain a correlation business is to compare it with a CDO business. So, just taking the case of, comparing the ABS correlation business to an ABS CDO business, I think the big, the main reason why they're different is in ABS CDO business, the deals are arranged to be able to be distributed. So the intention when ABS CDOs are put into place is you would essentially put together an ABS CDO deal. There will be different parts of the capital structure with different ratings. So you'll have, anywhere between AAA to the equity, which will be issued. And the intent will be to distribute, all of these tranches. And the intent would be for none of these tranches to be warehoused or to be part of the bank's inventory for a long period of time. That is the intent of a CDO deal when it's put together. The ABS correlation business, if you compare it against that, is is a business where, you know, you do not put together the entire capital structure. You only issue only one tranche of it, which is customized for an account, which is a very bespoke tranche. And the objective is not to issue any more tranches of that. It's not a fully distributed structure, but it's more of a trading business in the sense that that single tranche which is issued then is risk managed by the ABS correlation desk. Now, the risk management would have lots of technicalities and all that, but even before going into that, that's how I would kind of look at the two business models. That's how I would distinguish a CDO business to a correlation business. So a CDO business is more of a distribution business. In the primary space, it's not really a trading business. You know, you just, you know, arrange different notes of the same CDO with an intent to sell or distribute all of them. The ABS correlation business, you just issue only one tranche, which is very customized for the client who is on the other side, who's taking on the risk, and then you essentially hedge that.
When you say you hedge that, you hedge it for the client? So you,
yes.
You engage in an additional trade for your client, which gives them some hedging on the first trade you did with them.
So client would come to us as an example. A client would come to an ABS correlation desk, for example, and the client would say that, you know, I like this particular portfolio, or which is either selected by a client, or the client would say that I have engaged, you know, a manager who is, you know, so-and-so manager who would pick the portfolio on my behalf. And the client would say that, you know, I want an exposure to, let's say, a tranche which is attaching at, you know, 20% and detaching at 25%. That's the tranche I want an exposure to. The ABS correlation desk then would issue a note which gives the client exposure to that tranche. Now, the client then has his tranche. The client is fine with it. The client does not want to hedge because the client wanted the risk exposure that the client got. So now the desk has the opposite exposure to the client, and the trading desk, since it's not, you know, a prop desk, the desk would now, it's a market-making desk, would need to go out and hedge that risk. So when I talk about hedging the risk, I'm talking about the ABS correlation desk.
Okay, so you're hedging for Citi, not for the client.
That's right.
That was my misunderstanding. I'm sorry. That's what I was trying to clarify in my own head. How would you get the bespoke tranche? Who would you purchase that from? Would that be a purchase you would make from another CDO?
No, these are, you know, typically the trades were, there were some trades which were done with other CDOs. But bulk of the activity was done with, you know, with investors. So, you know, you would typically have an insurance company or a bank who wanted to take exposure to, you know, this structure, you know, as an investment. So it typically was an investment for banks or for insurance companies. So it was an investment product. Now, so typically the way, if you look at, you know, where the different deals were, what kind of clients participated in different parts of a capital structure. In the senior parts of the capital structure, you would typically see, you know, banks and insurance companies because, you know, they liked the highly, you know, the higher ratings because, you know, the lower ratings, their own regulatory capital consumption was much higher. So they would go for the higher tranche of the capital structure. Then you would see some, you know, bank investment arms like prop desks going for more junior parts of the capital structure. By junior, I mean like triple B type of capital structure. And that's where you would also see some CDOs buy this as an investment product on the triple B part of the capital structure. And on the equity part of the capital structure, you would typically find, you know, very sophisticated accounts like hedge funds who participated in that.
And did the ABS, I'll call them bespoke trades, the ABS correlation desk bespoke trades, and please correct me if my if how I'm describing this is not correct, would there be an, would these be RMBS subprime backed products?
I mean, I think at this stage it's, you know, I think it's good to, I mean, if you think this is a good time to also talk about the progression of the ABS correlation business, at least at Citigroup. I'm not aware of whether the same thing happened in other firms.
Okay.
But I think that probably will give you a better perspective of, you know, what kind of collateral was used and how the, over time. So if you're okay with that, should I just describe that now?
That would be perfect.
Okay, so, you know, the business at Citi started around, you know, the ABS correlation business in Citi started around 2003, 2004. I think towards the end of 2003 and beginning of 2004 is when one of the first deals were done. And, I mean, I would also like to emphasize this is all from memory. So, you know, the dates could be off by a few months. But that's when the business started. And originally when the business was done, you know, there were no synthetics, there was no CDS market on ABS, so it was all, the collateral was all bonds, all cash. So on the back of the cash collateral, you know, the desk did some transactions to start off the book. And if you look at the collateral which was done then, was a pretty diverse collateral. I mean, at least the deals I remember were deals where the collateral was, you know, both European and U.S., and if you look at the U.S. collateral, some of the earlier deals I remember would have subprime of, you know, anywhere between 5 to 15%, and the rest was non-subprime collateral. And
can I stop you there for one second, Mr. Bhatia?
Sure.
You're saying you recall the subprime content in the 2003 and 4 was 5 to 15%. Is that across the industry? Because you weren't at Citi at that point.
I'm sorry. I'm talking about Citi's trades in particular. I'm not aware of the industry because, it's, you know, as we just said, I was not working. My background was not in ABS before I came to Citi.
So is this something that you've learned about from others, but you are speaking about Citi's ABS correlation desk?
So I'm just passing in particular the facts regarding Citi's ABS correlation business.
Okay, but these are Citi-specific facts?
Yes, these are Citi-specific facts.
Okay, thank you. I'm sorry to interrupt.
That's fine. So, you know, in 2003, 2004, you know, the deals were started with cash collateral. These were deals which were, as we discussed, bespoke transactions. The subprime component in the deals I remember, one of the initial deals were 5 to 15%. And the reason I remember this is, again, to state the obvious, like I was not at Citi when the deals were done, but looking at the book since I started getting involved in the book, that's what I remember of it. And then the big change in the market for ABS synthetics happened towards the end of 2005. And in beginning of 2006, when the CDS on ABS market, you know, developed, I think the CDS market became active, started becoming active towards the end of 2005. The ABX index in particular, you know, came about in January of, I think, 2006. So the business model of the desk changed from the end of 2005 to beginning of 2006. To do those, you know, fully distributed ABS CDO type transactions, like what a typical ABS CDO desk would do, but do it with collateral which is synthetic, which is not cash bonds. So essentially, the business model was to take advantage of the CDS market to essentially provide exposure to the CDO through the synthetics rather than through cash. So in 2006. If you look at the main transactions which were intended to be fully distributed transactions. Now, in 2006, you know, I think the desk did do some single bespoke transactions, but the bulk of the exposure which the desk put on was for these intended fully distributed capital structure trades.
That makes sense.
I'm sorry? Did we lose you?
No, we're still here. I think somebody had... We heard it. We heard somebody mention something, but we couldn't make it out. But I think Mr. Batia had finished his answer.
Okay. A couple questions here. So I think you mentioned then by the 2006 time period, when you got to Citi, the business model of the ABS correlation desk was to do fully distributed cap and fully...
What was synthetic backing?
Yes, that was big part of the that was big part of the business model. I mean, as I mentioned, there was some bespoke deals which the desk was also doing.
Right.
But the big part of the exposure was the fully distributed transactions.
Okay.
I mean, just for the record, I don't know whether that came out clearly or not, or whether you're aware of it.
Okay.
My involvement in the on the desk, started in 2007.
Well, I wanted to table, and thank you for the background explanation, but if we could table that and talk about what you were doing when you were hired at Citi in August of 2006.
Sure. So I was hired in 2006 to run Citi's credit correlation business.
Mm-hmm. Was that in New York? You were hired to work in London?
My job was it was a global role, so I was running the business globally. I was then located in London, so I was hired out of I was hired into the London office.
Okay. And who did you report to at that time?
I reported to Michael Rains.
Okay. Were you a direct report?
Yes.
Okay. And did you have interaction with the CDO desk at that time?
Well, not officially. I was, we had our risk meetings where, I would be there presenting the risks in the credit correlation business while the CDO folks and ABS correlation folks would do that for their own businesses.
Okay. When we talk about, when we use the language synthetic CDOs, would all synthetic CDOs be done on the ABS correlation desk?
I'm not sure about the answer to that question. As we discussed, the ABS correlation desk was definitely using synthetic collateral as the crux of their transactions, but it could be, I think, that for some of the cash deals we have done could be synthetic buckets as well, so it was more like hybrid deals. But to be honest, I'm not 100% positive on the cash side of the business as to, what size of the market were these hybrid transactions. But I believe some of the synthetic collateral could have been used in the cash deals, in these hybrid cash deals.
But is it the correct terminology to say that the correlation desk that you ran in 2006 and 2007 was doing synthetic CDOs?
Yeah, so the desk which I ran on in 2006 was the credit correlation desk, which was doing, which are doing trades which are called synthetic CDOs with credit underlying as collateral. Yes.
Okay.
And in 2007, I continued on my responsibility for the credit correlation business, which was doing similar deals in 2007 as well.
Okay. Are you at Citi now?
Yes, I am.
Okay. And do you have the same role?
I actually am running a group right now called Portfolio and Exotics Credit Derivatives, which is you know, which is effectively the remaining parts of the old business or the original business, which we refer to as then global structured credit products.
Does that mean you effectively have the responsibilities that Michael Raines had in 2007?
Yes. So what we had done in 2007 was we had taken our business, which you know, the structured credit business, which we did not deem to be the core business. We had moved that business to our holding company, and whatever the core business that remained is what I'm heading right now.
Okay. But did you remained the head of the correlation, the global correlation desk, until when?
This was all these changes in terms of when I started running this new group called Portfolio and Exotic Credit Derivatives. These changes came about when Michael Raines left. I should remember this, but I don't remember the exact date. I think it probably is in November of 07.
Okay. But up until the time that Michael Raines left Citi, you remained the head of the global correlation desk?
Yes.
Okay. What percentage, well, let me start with, what was the volume of synthetic CDOs that Citigroup was doing through your desk in 2006 and 2007?
Is your question specific to ABS correlation or?
Yes, thank you.
ABS correlation, I mean, in 2006, I again, this is from memory, I recall us probably looking at around 5 or 6 fully distributed transactions. So essentially, you know, setting us up, you know, in ramping up the collateral for around 5 and 6 fully distributed deals. That's 2006. I think in addition, what we probably would have done are a few, I would say 5, 6, again from memory, around 5, 6, you know, single bespoke transactions as well.
And in 2007?
In 2007, I think what we did was we probably would have done 1 or 2 fully distributed deals, but I think those were the deals where we already had the collateral. So, and again, this is from memory. You can go back and check the risk reports. I think the collateral we had already ramped in 2006, but I think just converting them into CDOs is probably what we did in early 2007. For at most 2 transactions. Then what I remember is the liquidity in the market was when my role, the reason why I got engaged in ABS correlation is when, you know, the liquidity, and this is in January 07 when I started looking at the risk of that, is when the liquidity in the market dropped, when, you know, the ABS correlation was coming into being and it kind of changed the dynamics of the market. That's when I got involved. And since then, I remember that in the summer of around towards the spring, early summer, you know, we probably did like 3 or 4 more bespoke transactions. But that's been, after that, I don't really recall us being, besides that, I don't recall us being active because the liquidity in the market was not there. Now, we did continue to hedge the book. The long risk positions we have through the summer.
Sorry, if you can bear with me, I'm writing down a few notes so I can keep my place here. On a synthetic CDO, if you could walk me through how that worked at Citigroup, it would be helpful. We've spoken to a number of people at Citigroup about how the cash CDO business works, and how investors are solicited, and an asset manager gets involved. How does a synthetic deal compare with that?
I think it's good to separate the two different side of the businesses. Are you talking about the bespoke side of the business or fully distributed side of the business?
Can we start with the fully distributed side of the business?
The fully distributed side of the business is, pretty much works the same way as a cash ABS CDO works. The only difference is that, rather than the CDO buying cash assets as collateral, what happens here is that the exposure in the CDO comes from CDO, selling protection to effectively the different dealer desks in the street. So, you'd view it as the same process, except that the collateral is synthetic rather than cash.
Would that be done? Would Citi be purchasing the protection and identifying the counterparties, or would that be done through an asset manager?
Well, it's for the deals, the fully distributed deals which were put into place. Again, from memory, I think majority of them were managed. So in the managed deal, the manager would be the one who would be directing, the CLO and or Citigroup what to do.
And how would a deal start? Would Citi find investors? Would investors come to Citi? Or would an asset manager come to Citi, again, on a synthetic, fully distributed CDO?
Typically, and again, since I was not in 2006, I can only, talk from memory, I think, and this was true at least for a couple of deals we had, where the deal would start typically with an equity investor, a lead equity investor who would come in and want to take exposure to the equity tranche. Traditionally, equity tranche is, since being the most risky, is the most difficult to customize and to place. So the equity investor would be the lead investor, and typically Citi would work with the equity investor to basically bring a manager to the deal which the equity investor is comfortable in.
And if we take a step back, how big was the correlation desk?
Big, sorry, in terms of
how
the...
How many people at Citi worked on the correlation desk?
I think at its peak it was around six people.
I'm sorry, six?
Yes. I mean, I'm not 100% sure. I think what I remember.
And once a lead equity investor came to Citi and identified the type of risk and return that they wanted to undertake, at that point, would the correlation desk engage in modeling and trying to figure out the ratings and the tranche sizes?
Yes, that's right.
And who on the correlation desk would do that?
In the correlation desk, there were traders and there were structurers. So the structuring part of the correlation, ABS correlation business, would then work with rating agencies to look at the rating agency tranching.
And would that be done prior to or relatively simultaneous to choosing an asset manager?
Typically an asset manager comes first because, asset managers have their own view on what kind of exposures they like, what kind of exposures they don't like. So some asset managers are comfortable trading, certain exposure, certain names, and others are not. So what will happen typically is that, the asset manager is chosen first, and then the asset manager, comes up with a model portfolio, which is what is used to get to the ratings of the tranches.
If you've been very helpful on this so far, but for the balance of this interview, if we could continue to talk about ABS products, which have some RMBS subprime component, that would be helpful.
Okay.
Were there asset managers that were comfortable in trading certain RMBS names and not others, in your experience?
No, actually, that was not the case. I guess what I meant was, you know, the readings of portfolios are very specific to the portfolio that is chosen. And if you go to, you know, different managers to ask them to choose a portfolio, you know, they would all come up with different portfolios just because, you know, they would view the risk-return trade-off differently in different names. And since the rating process is so portfolio-specific, that's why the first step is the choosing of a manager, then getting from them a portfolio that they intend to wrap up.
Were the conversations with the rating conversations with the rating agencies, did those happen between the city structuring desk and the asset manager, or just the city structuring desk and the credit rating agencies?
Sorry, I cannot answer that question because, you know, when those conversations were happened, I think the bulk of them happened in 2006. So I was not involved in the business then. Just my, you know, gut feel would be that it would be done between the desk and the rating agencies, but iterating separately with the asset managers.
I'm sorry, what would happen separately with the asset managers?
And iterating separately with the asset managers.
So is it correct that the asset manager would have a conversation with the city's structuring desk about what the asset manager wanted, and then the city structuring desk would take that information and have separate conversations with the rating agencies?
Yes.
And who at city would have the conversations with the rating agencies?
I mean, as I said, there were structures in the ABS correlation business.
And who
would have the conversation? I think the structuring team had, you know, three people. I don't know out of the three exactly had the conversation.
Who was on the structuring
desk? So we can always take that information and come back to you.
Sure. Do you know who was on the structuring desk in 2006?
Yes. I mean, I know who was running the desk, and I know one or two other members of the desk. There's some members whose name I don't remember.
Who was running the desk?
Chris Carman was running the desk.
Okay. What other names do you remember from the structuring desk?
I might not be pronouncing the name correctly, but one of the persons of the key guys on the desk was Jaime, I think Aldama was his name. I think it's Aldama was his last name. Then there was another person who left the bank, I think probably around 2006. Who went to, I think, Lehman Bank, Lehman. I think his name is Juan Quintas, Quintas. Those are the two names I remember.
And, I'm sorry, who were the traders on the correlation desk in 2006?
I mean, these are all traders and structures, so they could both. I think some are focusing more on structuring, some are focusing more on trading.
Okay.
I'm not, you know, 100% sure as to, you know, who was having chat with rating agencies and who was doing the client business.
Okay. Did you ever have conversations with the rating agencies during this process?
No.
Okay. So a lead equity investor would come to Citi. Citi would obtain an asset manager for the deal, and then conversations would ensue between the asset manager and the structuring group, and at some point the rating agencies?
Yes.
Is that accurate? Okay. And on a synthetic CDO, how long would the process from lead equity investor interest to deal closing take, typically?
I'm sorry, I don't know the answer to that question. I was not exposed to a full process.
Were you exposed to a single full process?
No, because by the time I started looking at the ABS correlation desk, you know, we already were in the place where, you know, the market was illiquid and we're not able to, you know, sell most of our inventory. So most of those discussions, you know, probably happened in 2006.
So in August, from August of 2006 to January of 2007, do I understand you to say that you were overseeing the completion of deals that had already been begun?
No, I was not involved in the ABS correlation business until January of 2007. So since the time I joined Citi, which is in August 2006 to January 2007, I was focusing only on the credit collateral, credit correlation transactions.
And what is a credit correlation process as opposed to the synthetic CDOs? I'm sorry, you've probably explained this, but if you could make that distinction for me, it would be useful.
Sorry, can you repeat the question, please?
Sure. From August of 2006, to January of 2007, I believe you said you were working on the credit correlation process and not the synthetic CDO process, right?
Yes.
Okay. So the credit correlation process.
Yeah.
What is that?
Well, so credit correlation is just it's a different product area as.
Let me ask a very basic question. I'm sorry, Mr. Batia, I don't mean to interrupt you, but I might be able to simplify this. Does it have anything to do with subprime exposure?
No.
Okay. That's good for purposes of this call. Because I do want to stay focused on that. Okay, so until January of 2007... is it fair to say you weren't involved in any product line at Citi that related to any subprime RMBS exposure?
That's correct.
Okay, that's useful, and I honestly don't mean to interrupt, but I want to be respectful of your time, and we do have a specific focus, so I won't torture you with my questions about credit correlation.
Sure.
Okay. Why were you asked to look at the synthetic CDO business in January of 2007?
The primary reason was the fact that, you know, the ABX index came about in January 2007, and the market, you know, also soon after that started trading tranches of the ABX index. So what generally happens when an index starts trading, or the tranches of ABX index starts trading, is, you know, that has implications on how you would risk manage your synthetic CDOs. And, you know, Michael Raines tagged me for my expertise in effectively on the credit collateral side of the business, because, you know, we went through a parallel phase when the corporate indices started trading and tranches of that started trading. It had an impact on the credit correlation market. So he wanted to tap into my expertise on the credit side to be able to lend that to ABS side. That was the primary reason why, you know, he asked me to look at the risks, start looking at the risks of the synthetic CDOs, the ABS correlation business, in January 2007. The second reason also was, which is the market had become illiquid then, and obviously there were general concerns about, you know, the amount of risks he had.
So by January 2007, there was a concern about illiquidity in the CDO market?
Yes.
And is that the first time that you became aware of any liquidity concern in the CDO market?
Yeah, I was not following the ABS CDO market, so that was when I first started getting exposure to that, yes.
Okay. But is it fair to say that it was in the context of some concern by Michael Raines and or others of a liquidity concern in that market that you were asked to take a closer look at that market?
Yes. I mean, as I said, liquidity concern was the secondary reason. The primary reason was more about new product developments happening in the marketplace, which was related to the ABX index.
So the new products related to the ABX index, would that be, I don't want to mischaracterize this, but from a layman's term, is that an increase in secondary trading in synthetic CDO tranches?
But it's trading of synthetic CDOs with ABX as the collateral, rather than bespoke. And generally, when ABX starts trading, the liquidity there is eventually higher than the bespoke.
When you say ABX as the collateral, do you mean reference to ABX?
Yes, exactly.
Okay, that's helpful. And so it would be at this point, would we be talking about a credit default swap referencing the ABX?
No, you're talking about, that's the ABX index. You're talking about a synthetic CDO referencing ABX.
Okay, so it would be a CDO structured to have the same cash flows as whatever the ABX was doing.
Yes, the underlying collateral would be ABX on the CDO.
And the ABX would be an index of how, can you explain to me what, the ABX was an index, yes?
Yes, ABX was an index.
And what was it tracking?
ABX was tracking, there are different rating buckets in the ABX index, but it was tracking subprime housing sector, and it was tapping, mimicking, or it was indexed meant to replicate the performance of the different tranches of subprime securitizations.
And a new synthetic product at this point would be just referencing the ABX, not actually purchasing equities from the ABX. Is that accurate?
It was just a synthetic CDO with ABX as the collateral. So, we talked about in the bespoke book, you put together transactions where you RAM the collateral synthetically. And here, the collateral would be those names which are part of the index.
But
that's the only difference.
Is it accurate to say, though, in the synthetic world, that you're merely referencing collateral? There is no underlying collateral.
Yes, you are referencing that collateral. You're right.
So in the event of default, for instance, there is no home to foreclose on. As far as
well,
the synthetic vehicle.
Well, you do wrap up collateral synthetically, so the CDO will sell protection. So there are two ways you can wrap collateral. On the cash bonds, you purchase the bonds.
So is it
synthetically, the way the CDO will wrap up collateral, it will sell protection. So
okay, so you're
in one, the synthetic trade, the other is obviously a cash trade.
So you're in the synthetic arena, you're relying on the credit of your CDS counterparty, again,
that's right,
not
right,
foreclosing on a house, for instance.
Well, you're relying on the you're relying on the counterparty risk because it's a swap trade. You have risk to your counterparty. But the risk to your counterparty is that, you know, whether if there are payments demanded on the synthetic swap between the CDO and the counterparty, whether the counterparty would be there to honor those payments.
Okay. So what, when you were asked to look at the risks, I think you said you got involved in January of 2007 to evaluate the new market and the risks therein. What did you do to evaluate the risks in the market?
So, you know, my main objective was to start working with our quantitative researchers about a model that would help us, that we would calibrate using the ABX, tranche prices. And then we can apply that model to pricing of our rest of our ABS correlation book. That was my main objective or my main focus. So the first focus was to calibrate, you know, our book to the ABX, whatever price discovery we were seeing or the risk discovery we were seeing in the ABX market. And the second objective was, after the calibration of the model, to look at, you know, what was the risk profile of the book. So that was kind of the main focus.
And did your group devise such a model?
Well, the model was, we started looking at the model, but, you know, unfortunately, you know, the modeling exercise here is quite complex, and, you know, before the model actually was completed, we made progress on that, but before the model was completed, you know, that's when, during summer, the ABS market became even more illiquid and price discovery or transparency became even bigger issue. And then, you know, any model is basically, you know, the premise of the model is liquid, transparent markets. The model was not really, the need for that model was not there anymore.
So you never actually did a fully distributed synthetic ABX referencing the ABX? Is that fair?
So you mean the transactions or the model?
Did you do any trades prior to the model being completed?
Well, so prior to the model being completed, we did trades, but that was 2006. And in 2007, you know, we did not do any new ramp ups and new trades on that.
But the trades that were done in 2006, that was prior to you being involved?
Yeah.
Okay. And who was involved at that point?
That was Chris Carman. He was running the desk there.
Okay. Did you have any conversations during this the period that you were involved in the ABS correlation from January 2007 onward with anyone in independent risk?
Yes, I did have conversations, and you know, a bulk of that conversation was on the model, on the, you know, the model I discussed regarding ABX, the calibration of the model.
And who from independent risk were you discussing the modeling with?
It was someone in, so the main person in charge of risk was Dominique Wallace. The person who was involved on the desk, and I'm not 100% sure, but I think his name was Ravi Savur, S-A-V-U-R.
S-A-B-U-R?
V as in Victor, U-R.
S-A-V-U-R, okay. And his first name, I'm sorry?
Ravi, R-A-V-I.
Okay. And did Dominique Wallace actually work in independent risk?
Yes.
And did he have a view on this particular modeling?
No, I mean, I think we all agreed that that was the right direction for us to go in. But besides that, you know, we didn't really discuss any particular views. I mean, I think the path we were taking to develop the model was the right path, made sense to everyone. That's why we were on that.
Okay. Does the ABX still trade? I'm sorry. I don't mean to ask you such a rudimentary question, but I think it will help me ask my next question.
It does trade, yes.
Okay. And the market did take a turn, you mentioned, with the liquidity in the summer of 2007. Has Citi since that time done any synthetic CDO deals?
Since 2007?
Yes.
I believe not, but I'm not 100% sure because, you know, when we were discussing in 2007 when Michael Raines left, the book, the ABS correlation book, was designated to our holding company. So I was not involved in that after that time.
I see. Okay. In the conversations that you had in 2007 regarding the modeling synthetic CDOs, did you have any conversations with regarding cash CDOs?
No, my focus was on ABS correlation.
Did you have any conversations at Citigroup with Nestor Dominguez?
I mean, I think we had, you know, as part of the risk calls we were in, you know, we were both involved in that, and I was involved, you know, together with Nestor Dominguez on in terms of after Chris Carman left, which was around July 2007, when then I started running the ABS correlation book. Then Nestor and I, you know, and Michael had conversations on making sure that, you know, the valuation we applied to the two books were consistent. So in that, we did have conversations.
You used the date July 2007. Did you have conversations with Nestor Dominguez prior to July 2007?
No, I mean, not regards to anything on the on any details on cash CDOs, no.
Did you have any conversations with regard to cash CDOs with anyone at Citi prior to July 2007?
Not outside the risk calls, you know, I talked about.
Okay. Who was on the risk calls?
All the desk heads were part of the risk call. So by desk heads, I mean, you know, everyone who reported to Michael Raines. Dominique Wallace from the risk side was invited to those calls. I believe, I'm not 100% sure, that Murray Barnes, who was independent risk manager in New York, I think he used to report to Dominic, I'm not 100% sure, was involved in that as well. And then, you know, and then Michael's bosses, which were Chad Lead and Mark, I'm forgetting his last name, he was in London. They were invited, they were there for some calls, but not for all the calls. And in some calls, you know, also had Randy and Jeff, who were Chad's and Mark's bosses. They would sometimes come in, but not that much. Mark's name, by the way, is Mark Watson. He was running the you know, the business with Chad Lee, but he was based in London.
Was Chad Lee in London or New York?
Chad Lee was in New York.
Okay.
Mark Watson, his counterpart, was in London.
Okay. And how frequently were these risk calls?
I think they were weekly. Again, I'm not 100% sure whether they're weekly or bi-weekly, but they were definitely regular calls.
And are these the, you mentioned sometimes Randy Barker and Jeff Cooley would be on these calls. Were these all the desk heads within fixed income?
No, this was just specific to what was then called Global Structured Credit Products. That was the business Michael Raines ran. It was just specific to that.
So these were just the desk heads under Michael Raines at that time?
That's right.
Okay. And did you participate in these from August 2006 onward?
Yes, I did.
And were they that frequent, weekly or bi-weekly?
Yes, I mean, I believe they were. I mean, I know that Michael Raines had started those meetings. I don't remember 100% when they started, which month in 06. But I believe they started in 06. I'm not 100% sure.
Were there any risk reports generated in conjunction with these meetings?
Yes, there were.
And what did those look like? I mean, what would be in a risk report?
I mean, each desk head had, you know, given an overview of the risks in their business. So each desk head had its, had their own version of the risk report, but the objective was to show the open risks which the desk had.
Were the reports just numerical, or did they also have narrative descriptions of risks and concerns?
I think it was mostly tables and charts and numbers, but there were also some comments on some of the line items. That's what I recall.
And did all of the desk heads circulate the risk reports to each other?
No, I think what happened was someone in business management, put it together for Michael Raines. So we all submitted our reports to that one centralized person.
Do you know who that was?
I'm sorry, I don't. I mean, I know the business management was. The person responsible for business management was Nancy Polson, but I'm not sure. I think the report went to someone who works for Nancy. I don't know who put it all together.
I'm sorry, you used the term business what? I'm sorry, business?
Manager,
okay. But the report wasn't generated through independent risk management. It was generated on the business side, not on the Barnes-Wallace side?
No, yeah. So this was a business meeting. So this was an in-business meeting. This was not an independent market risk management meetings. So this was business meetings. The risk reports were generated by the business, but as I mentioned, you know, the risk folks, I think, were invited to that.
Okay.
Again, I mean, a lot of these things are from memory from 06. So we'll have to obviously check that.
Okay. No, and I appreciate you helping us understand the structure and internal workings, which is a challenge for us. Do you recall any conversations in prior to July of 2007 on these risk? In these risk meetings or calls regarding cash CDOs?
Yes, I mean, when we went through the risk reports on cash CDOs, you know, we did talk about the, the inventory we had. We did talk about the risks which were there, where, you know, Nestor and Janice kind of gave an overview on, on the risk positions in the business. So, you know, we did have conversation on that during the risk calls.
What are your earliest recollections of the risks in the cash CDO business?
I mean, we clearly were long risk, in 06, and you know, we were, so the discussions essentially were centered around, you know, the nature of the risk, what was the size of the risk we were long, and the strategy to basically, you know, effectively, you know, place those positions. The risk, I mean, as I mentioned, the risk calls didn't go into a lot of details of every book because, you know, the business is under Michael Raines. There were multiple businesses under Michael Raines. Even in the cash CDO side, you know, there was a primary business and there was a secondary trading business. So, and then, as I mentioned, I was running the credit correlation side of the business. In 06, there was also Chris Carman running the ABS correlation side of the business. And then, you know, we also had another business called Illiquids Trading, where we had both books in New York and London. So, you know, the risk meetings, I believe, were hour and a half, and where all these different books were covered. So I think it was just an overview of the position and some brief discussion on strategy.
I'm sorry, did you say the Illiquids Trading?
Yes.
What is that?
That is essentially, you know, any deal which you hedge by proxy, it's not directly hedgeable. So, you know, you might put on a trade which is, I don't know, financing, let's say some shipbuilders. That's an example. I don't know whether Citi did that trade or not, but it's more of financing type trades which were done. And that's what done through the liquids desk.
Do you specifically recall in 2006, by 2006, being aware that Citigroup was, as you mentioned, a long on risk in its cash CDO business?
Yeah.
And what can you tell me about those conversations in 2006 on being long in the cash CDO business? What was Citi doing in 2006 about that fact?
I think the bulk of the conversations were in terms of, monitoring the positions and, making sure that, you know, what, and discussing the positions we were long in our inventory. So all the CDOs we had issued, we were long in the inventory, talking about, you know, the progress we had made in distributing any of that risk.
In the course of any of these meetings, do you recall any conversations about, were there any conversations about positions or risks or trading strategies that the business side wanted to undertake that independent risk disagreed with?
You know, I don't remember any of that happening, but also a function of, you know, since I did not have exposure, I did not understand the ABS market, so even when I was looking at the positions, I did not have a full understanding of, you know, what the risks were all about. But I don't remember any meeting where there was any disagreement there.
Do you recall conversations about the super senior tranches that Citi had on its balance sheet?
Not from 06, no.
When do you first recall those conversations?
I mostly got involved in those and recall those conversations starting end of July when Chris Carman left. And my involvement again came from the ABS correlation side because in ABS correlation business there was some super senior exposures also. So the nature of the conversations were, you know, working together with a cash business to make sure that when we look at the super senior risks and the other inventory risks, we look at consistent to how the cash business did that.
I'd like to talk a little bit about your involvement from July 2007 through
sure.
November 2007. But before I do, if I could utilize your knowledge again and ask some more basic questions that might help me. When Citi did a cash CDO and was working, we understand Citi offered up its balance sheet in a warehousing agreement with the asset manager. At the point of deal close, is it accurate that all of the assets were transferred into a special purpose vehicle?
I mean, I'm sorry, I was not involved in the cash business, so...
I'm just trying to understand the logistics of it.
Yes, I mean, that would make sense, but I don't know for sure. I would assume that would be the case, yes.
What I'm not clear on, and I think we've been, unfortunately, in some of the conversations I've been involved in, I think I've been guilty of using the wrong language of Citi retaining the super senior tranches. What I'm trying to understand is, in fact, did the assets go into a special purpose vehicle from which Citi actually purchased the super senior bonds?
Yeah, typically in a CDO issuance. I mean, since I was not part of the cash business, I don't have experience with any specific transaction.
Okay.
But typically in the cash business, what happens is, that all the different tranches are issued ranging from equity to super senior. And then if you don't place any tranches as a dealer, then, you retain those in your warehouse book, obviously with the intention of selling them.
I guess that's what I don't understand, and if you can't speak to it, maybe we can find somebody else who can. But it's this language of retaining that I don't understand. Are they... Because technically, the asset manager purchased them on Citi's balance sheet, but I guess I don't understand who owns them at that point.
Donna, I'm happy to walk you through it later.
Perfect.
It's just like an institutional investment grade underwriting of bonds. There's really no difference.
I guess you're probably assuming I know more about that than I do. And I can have that conversation with you, Susanna. I just want to make sure that I'm not misspeaking when I use the terminology that Citi retained, if in fact what they did was purchase them from a special purpose vehicle that was set up. That's where we're just confused about describing it accurately.
I think it makes absolutely no difference, but I'm happy to talk about it.
Excellent. Mr. Batia, if we go back to the distinctions between the cash CDOs and the synthetic CDOs.
Yeah.
Would the coupons on the bonds of the cash CDOs be comparable to the coupons on the bonds of the synthetic CDOs, or would one be...
I think they would not be exactly the same, but they would be comparable.
Okay. How would you compare the returns on a cash CDO with the returns on a synthetic CDO? Would one be higher or lower than the other?
It'll be very comparable because, the returns are, overall, the returns on the different liabilities that are issued in a CDO are a function of the underlying collateral. So if you take exposure, if the CLO takes, CDO takes exposure to that collateral using cash instruments or using synthetic instruments, I think the returns will be fairly comparable because between cash and synthetic, there's obviously a linkage because one cannot become more cheap or rich than the other.
What I'm
so
trying
the,
to understand is, would there be a higher return on the synthetic CDO because of the counterparty risk as opposed to, again, the underlying collateral risk?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think, you know, in hindsight, you know, they are counterparty risks which should be priced in, which we know now. But at that point in time, you know, counterparty risk was not really on top of people's mind, at least on large dealers.
So is it fair to say that in 2006 time frame, they were priced similarly, but looking back, you might not make that judgment?
Yes. I mean, obviously the counterparty risk issues, you know, are, we know that they're pretty significant. And, you know, so you would, you know, you would look at those differently. But at that point in time, you know, the counterparty risk was not in forefront of anyone's mind or the market's mind. So I think the returns in terms of the CDOs, what the different liability tranches paid, were pretty comparable.
Okay. And that leads me to my first question was to compare the returns of a cash CDO with a synthetic CDO. And my second question was going to ask you to compare the risks of a cash CDO with the risks of a synthetic CDO. And if you could do that, again, with sort of the comparable risks in a, as best you can, a 2006 conversation, and then maybe how looking back that
I mean, I think the risk.
And actually, maybe before you respond, I mean, I think, Donna, I should have spoke up when you asked your last question. Returns to whom and risks to whom? What is the question you're asking?
Thank you. That's an excellent question. And maybe if you could break that down, the returns, with the returns, I was thinking of the returns to the investor on the coupons. And is that what you spoke to, Mr. Batista?
Yeah, I was talking about returns to the investor. And
would, can I ask the second question, and thank you, Ms. Burgle, for leading me in that direction. Would the returns to Citi be the same on a cash CDO and a synthetic CDO, meaning the profit?
Sure. No, I mean, the CDO business is a fee business. So for every CDO you put together, you get a certain, you know, points of fee on the size of the portfolio. So, you know, I don't remember exactly what the fee terms were, whether they were different for cash CDOs or for synthetic CDO, but the P&L comes from, you know, the fee you make, and I don't know exactly what the different fees were. I think we need to go and look at that.
Okay. And is that something that, with assistance from counsel, that you said you're still at Citi in that business line?
Yeah.
Is that something you could, with assistance for counsel, look at and provide back to us?
Yeah, I mean, we can take a look at some sample deals as to what the fee arrangement was in those fees.
And
I can,
Donna, we can just provide you with the documents, and you can see for yourself what the fees were. We're happy to give you a few sets of documents for synthetic deals and a few sets for the cash deals, and you can review the documents and then assess the fee.
Well, and I guess what I would like in addition would be some guidance from Mr. Batista or someone from Citi as to just a fairly generic representation that, you know, Citi made similar profit margins on cash CD or didn't. I don't know if it was a more profitable or less profitable, but that's what I'm trying to figure out.
Yeah, I think that we should maybe also put this in, and it's Mr. Batia, not Batista. I think we should perhaps add that to our agenda for discussion at the end of the call.
Okay.
The fee terms for each deal are set forth in the agreements for the deal, and we'd be happy to provide you with those agreements, and you can evaluate the respective terms and compare them.
Okay. And Mr. Batia, I am very sorry for mispronouncing your name. It's a challenge to conduct an interview over the telephone with someone I've never met, and I'm sorry for the inconvenience to you as well.
That's fine.
But I certainly appreciate your helpfulness on this call. But let me ask my question a different way again, and I appreciate counsel's helpful comments as well. But Mr. Bhatia, in your mind, in 2006, do you have any reason to believe one way or another that the synthetic CDO business was more or less profitable than the cash CDO business? And if you can take volume out of that, just whether it would be more profitable to do a synthetic deal than to do a cash deal or not?
No, I don't know for sure. I mean, one thing I think you would want to probably also take into account that the cash business was a business which was a very established business then. The synthetic was kind of a new product. So I'm sure whenever a new product comes in, there are new, details you need to work out from a structuring perspective, from the documentation perspective. So I don't know whether that would imply a synthetic would have a higher fee or not. I'm not sure. But, that would be the only thing I would think as to how the deals are different. One was a new market emerging at that time. The other was a relatively established business.
In general, do new products carry a slightly higher premium?
Yes. I mean, as I mentioned, the CDO business, was viewed by us as a fee business. It was a volume business. So, the way the business would be looked at is, how many structures involved in the transaction for how many hours, right? It's more of a management consultant like a pricing you would look at. So new product like CDS, ABS, CDO, I could imagine that, kinks would need to work out on the documents. You would need to, work more with the rating agencies. And since everyone is looking at this from a new perspective, I'm sure it takes more time than a regular cash deal. But would that translate? Did that translate to a higher or lower fee? I'm not sure. I've not seen those agreements. I'm not sure about that.
Okay. I appreciate that. Your helpful response. One of the things that I was going to ask you, because I'd like to get to July 2007, but I want to think somewhat orderly here. Is there any concept of CDO squares in the synthetic world?
Yes, there is a concept of that, yes.
Sorry, that was a very poorly worded question, but I appreciate you helping me with it. And if you could give me any explanation that could walk me through that, it would be helpful too.
Sure. Your question was, did CDO square transaction, did they get done in synthetic space? And, I know that, at Citi, we did at least two trades, which I remember, in 07. I'm not sure whether, we have any other transaction there. I don't remember the book to know if there's anything which was done apart from these two.
Can you explain to me what a synthetic CDO square would look like?
Yes, it's what it would be. It would be a CDO where the underlyings are not single name RMBS, but the underlyings are CDOs themselves.
Are all CDO squares considered synthetic?
No, because you can have a cash CDO, which buys other cash CDOs within the collateral pool, either the collateral pool, either small or a big part of the collateral pool. So synthetic, so CDO squared could be both cash as well as synthetic.
Okay. So I guess if you could walk me through the two trades that you did in 2007 that were synthetic CDO squares.
Sure. The trades, I think both trades are very similar. What the trades were, we I think packaged I think we packaged the AAA risk. I think we took I don't know how many bonds from memory. Probably were around 10 to 20 bonds. I'm not 100% sure, but we took 10 or 20 AAA bonds. We packaged them into a CDO and bought protection on a senior tranche of that from a client.
And Mickey, apologies, this is Susanna. Were these are trades you're speaking of out of the London area, just to be clear?
Yes, these are the ABS correlation trades.
And were those bespoke trades that you're describing? Not fully ramped trades?
These are bespoke trades, yes.
Okay.
I don't know about cash CDO as to whether there were any trades or not on that side.
And when you say cash CDO, you're using that to refer to the desk in New York. I mean, Ms. Norman's question went to synthetic, I think, intentionally, but you're saying out of the desk in New York, you're not sure what they may have done.
That's right. That's correct.
Okay.
Mr. Batia, you said you packaged 10 to 20 junior AAA bonds into a CDO?
Yeah.
And then there's a where is the, and then you bought protection against that. Is that correct?
Yeah, we took that's the 10 to 20 CDOs. And then put them in as part of the, made them the collateral pool and bought protection on the senior tranche of that. Since the collateral pools were CDOs themselves, that was a CDO squared.
Since the collateral pools were CDOs themselves, okay. And did you sell the junior tranches of that?
I think we placed some tranches. I don't recall 100% now whether we did, I think, two trades, whether we did both trades, the senior trades, or we did one junior or one senior trade. But we did not place all parts of the capital structure of the CDO squared. We placed only, one or two parts of the capital structure.
And the part that Citi did not place, it bought CDS protection against?
Yeah, so we only bought protection against the parts we placed. The parts we did not place, we did not buy protection. This is one of those bespoke, ABS correlation trades where you only buy protection on the parts which you place with clients.
Okay. Is one of these two trades Ridgeway funding too?
I don't.
No, it's not. That was out of the New York desk, not London.
Okay. That's probably what you were establishing earlier. I appreciate that.
And the Ridgeway 2 deal was not a synthetic deal, and it was not a CDO squared, so it wouldn't be responsive to your question in the first instance.
I didn't think it was, but the protection part started to sound a little like it, so I thought I would ask. But thank you. So why did you buy protection against the the bonds you sold?
So against the this was a bespoke transaction.
Yes.
Where what the client wanted to do is to take exposure through a CDO squared on senior parts of the capital structure. So effectively, at that point in time, and I think the trade was priced around spring and the AAAs were trading down, and which many people thought was the liquidity reason. So that was the way for the client to get leveraged exposure on those AAAs.
I guess I'm not clear then. The CDS protection that Citi purchased, did you purchase it for your client or for Citi?
Well, any ABS correlation, bespoke ABS correlation trade, we purchase from client for the book, and then, we hedge it on the book. I think this was kind of the very first thing we talked about the ABS correlation space. of what ABS correlation meant. This is a trade which, you know, where the dealer desk, in this case Citi, you know, trades with the client, buys protection from the client on the portfolio and the tranche which the client wants. And then that is hedged by Citi. It's not placed because this is not a fully distributed deal.
Okay. But the is it accurate that the collateral you're purchasing and the protection that you're purchasing are both for the client? You're not betting against the client here.
No, it's by definition when you do an ABS correlation deal, you're betting against the client because the client is selling protection and the desk is buying protection. But then what the desk does is goes and hedges the risk in the market to hedge themselves. So the client and basically the dealer desk is on the opposite side of the trade by definition because they're trading with each other and it's a synthetic trade. So the way the client, the dealer will then hedge is that the dealer will go in and sell protection in the market to hedge that. Yeah, so the dealer is effectively neutral in that case because the dealer is hedged.
You said you did two synthetic CDO squares, you think?
What I remember is two in 07. And I can obviously confirm that number and also see if there were any other CDO square trades done before that, in like in 06 when I was not involved in the book, in the ABS correlation book.
And in, do you know what ballpark the volume combined of these two deals was?
I'm sorry, I don't remember the sizes.
Or would they be collectively over $2 billion?
No, I think the size probably would be 250 to 500 at most.
I'm sorry, say that again?
50 million to 500 million at most, that's the range.
Oh, 200 to 500 million.
I would guess right now.
And do you know if Citi lost money on those trades? Or it sounds like they were hedged.
Yeah, I mean, Citi net, lost money on ABS correlation book. So, you know, that was kind of the end result of it all. So obviously Citi was, you know, long risk at the end.
Okay. And let me ask a very basic question. What went wrong in Citi's hedging analysis to result in it losing money on the ABS correlation book?
I mean, I think there were two things that went wrong. I don't know, you know, whether those two things, you know, now in hindsight they're wrong, whether at that point in time you could have predicted would go wrong or not. Is the first thing is that, you know, at Citi, you know, we relied a lot on our distribution. You know, our distribution of CDOs was, you know, functioned really well until crisis hit us. So, you know, I remember statistics, you know, 6 of something like, you know, Citi doing, you know, one CDO a week. So we relied a lot on our distribution, and whenever you have a distribution business, then, you know, you ultimately start wrapping a lot of transactions at the same time because, you know, you have a pipeline of these deals which are pricing every week going forward. Now, what happened was I think we were relying a bit too much on our distribution as a risk management source. So when the market stops, when the market becomes illiquid, when people stop buying the CDOs, then you're left with a lot more inventory. You know, if Citi was pricing, you know, rather than one deal a week, was pricing one deal a month, we would be ramping at the same time much fewer deals, and the size of the losses for us would be much smaller. So I think that's the first thing which went wrong for Citi, which is basically relying on distribution, relying too much on distribution as a risk mitigation source, or giving too much confidence in distribution, and not really foreseeing that the markets would stop or could stop and then the distribution would stop. I think that's the first risk which Citi took, which in hindsight, you know, is a wrong risk to take. The second is, you know, the super senior positions, because for the super senior positions, the intent was to keep them. And the intent was driven by the fact that, you know, these things were, at that point in time, trading around, you know, not even a quarter of a percent. So the idea was that these are positions which were relatively risk-free. And therefore, you know, the size of the position that got added on between both cash business and the ABS correlation business, on ABS correlation business, you know, the size of subprime super senior was approximately, I think, $6 billion. But, you know, in hindsight, you know, that whole exposure with Citi did across cash and synthetic on the super senior was quite large. But, you know, I always look back to see whether at that point in time we would have kind of predicted as something which trades at a quarter of a percent, which some of that would trade around, you know, whatever, you know, 10,000 basis, 10% or spread of 100% price of zero. It's difficult to predict that, but looking in hindsight, obviously the concentration which we had was quite large.
Did you mentioned the intent was to keep them because they were considered very low risk, I think?
Yes, the super seniors were considered as very safe risk, yes.
Okay. Do you recall that being the intention to keep them, or was it just because they were low, as opposed to the fact that they were low risk meant that nobody else really wanted to buy them either because the returns were low? Do you know one way or another?
No, I don't know one way or the other. When I started looking at the ABS correlation book, we had you know, as I mentioned, we had $6 billion of that risk, and you know, the discussions were not there in terms of, you know, whether we would hedge those or not. So, you know, I think there was a comfort with that risk given the fact it was a very senior risk.
I'm sorry, did you say you had $6 billion of super senior exposure on the ABS correlation desk?
Yes.
And did you ever try to sell it?
I don't recall trying to sell it because, you know, by the time, you know, I started looking at the book, the liquidity was very prevalent, and so there were no buyers of very little buyers of structured risks.
Did you ever have conversations with any of your predecessors as to how that much was amassed in one place, or why it was sitting on the books?
No.
Did you ever have a feeling or understanding as to whether other major market participants were exposed in the same way to super senior positions?
I mean, I didn't know for a fact as to how much super senior other dealers had, but my understanding was, you know, people with dealers with high volume business and a comparables, there were Merrill Lynch was one where the CDO volumes were quite as big. I think we were number one. They were behind us. But, you know, my understanding was that all the desks, all the dealers who were very active in CDOs had also an active inventory as well, spread over, you know, super senior to more junior tranches. And as I mentioned, the inventory had to be maintained to feed the pipeline which was coming in the foreseeable future.
I'm sorry, you mean the... But you don't mean the super seniors there. You mean the inventory.
Yes.
I'm sorry. I for purposes of, since we're taping, I'm afraid we're going to get a terrible recording here. But when you say the inventory had to be maintained for the pipeline, you're talking about the ongoing warehousing to create new CDOs.
Yes, I am. Yeah.
Forgive me for re-asking a similar question in the same way, but one of the things we've been trying to understand is just the rationale behind how the super seniors ended up on Citi's books. And just from a risk management perspective, whether it was just sort of a lost leader that it was good business for Citi to take that position because its clients wanted the other positions? or whether Citi was making an intentional, whether Citi thought that they were profitable and wanted to have that particular product on its books.
I'm not sure what the answer to that question is, since I was not around when these things were put on, so I don't know what the rationale then was.
From the ABS correlation desk, can you tell me the $6 billion in super senior exposure? How profitable was that? I mean, you said it was paying a quarter percent? Is that...
I think initially when it was taken down, it was probably... not more than a quarter percent. I don't know exactly at what price it was taken down. But, in the ABS correlation business, it was part of this fully distributed transaction, which the business started ramping up in 2006. And there the business, didn't sell, in many cases, even the junior tranches, let alone the super senior. So the desk was just long risk in super senior as well as junior tranches.
From a pricing perspective on CDOs, are the coupons that the tranche coupons, are they fixed or variable?
The tranche coupons are typically fixed.
And can you give me, looking at a typical in 2006, and it can be synthetic since that, you mentioned the pricing was somewhat comparable, what kind of ranges would there be on the coupons in the you mentioned the super seniors would be a quarter percent. What about the senior position that was sold? What would the coupon be on that?
The senior positions I would say, and again this is from memory, would be around half a percent.
And the mezzanines?
And then the junior tranches would go as high as, they'd go up the rating scale, they would go as high as, I would say, between 2.5% to 3.5% for typically a triple B-like tranche.
And the equity?
Equity coupon would be, in many cases, would not be stated. I mean, equity would get the residual cash flow, typically, in these transactions. So equity, people look at more not in coupon, but... what is the rate of return in the different default scenarios? That's typically, people look at for equity, and equity investors, usually demand in return of anywhere around 10% or higher, depending on basically the type of collateral and so on.
How high would that go in the synthetic CDO world?
Since equity does not have a stated coupon, I'm not sure how high that would go. It would be a function of the performance of the portfolio.
What would be the return that an investor that came to Citi in the synthetic CDO space, in the your lead equity investor, what would be the highest sort of return that you would be trying to model for them, bearing in mind that they bore a lot of risk and it might not work out that way?
Sure. I mean, I think I don't know the exact answer to your question because spreads were fairly tight then. It was a different environment, so I don't know exactly what the deals would model as the base case coupon. But I would assume it would be around 11-12% because what the equity investors were what their target was at that point in time. But I don't know specifically where our deals model to.
Okay. And did these pay quarterly or monthly or?
Typically, they pay quarterly.
Okay. And when we were talking about them being fixed, is that fairly consistent, or did that vary as well? In the ABS CDO context, were they always fixed?
The coupons are fixed.
Okay.
I think there are certain nuances of the deals wherein, what is the coupon is, in some deals, the coupon is based on a different notional. which is the technicality of these deals, which I don't remember now. In some deals, you know, they're called write-down structures. So as the losses happen, the principal is written down. In some deals, the principal, you know, is not written down immediately. It's written down towards the end of the deal. So the coupon is fixed as a percentage, but, you know, the size of the tranche is the one that varies depending on, you know, what type of structure the deals were done under.
Okay. And I suppose some of them may be over-collateralized as well, changing the calculus on that? Is that...
Second is that?
If a deal is over-collateralized, would that also mean that the coupon was on a smaller notional?
No, I think the collateral test, yes. I mean, the collateral test would divert cash flows away from some tranches to some more senior tranches. So I think they'll affect the coupons to the extent the coupon gets diverted to make the deals more stable for the senior investors. But the stated coupon will not change with this statistic.
Okay, that makes sense. Let me go through my notes here if I can for a second. If we can go back to July of 2007, what was your involvement in July 2007 in either trying to de-lever or assess the risks or in any other way on the
CDO business? In 2007, in July, you know, I don't recall exactly when Chris Carman left, but when Chris Carman was running the desk and left, then I took over running the APS correlation desk. And my focus, you know, starting then was to look at the risks in the book to see, you know, how we would de-risk the book. And that was kind of the bulk of my focus on that.
What did you do to de-risk the book?
Well, I mean, I think we were, so what we, the only, the CDO market was, at that point in time, you know, completely illiquid, so we could not really take our CDOs, which were there in the inventory and ABS correlation book, sell those, because there are no buyers of that. So the only way we could hedge the book is buying, you know, protection on single MRMBS in synthetic form, which is what we did. So starting August and September, you know, we became just active in terms of purchasing of this protection.
Were you ever aware of any time in the in early 2007 when the cash CDO business was increasing its purchasing to take advantage of distressed buying opportunities?
No, I was not aware of it, no.
Prior to me just asking that question, is that something you've ever heard?
No.
Did you have any involvement or conversations regarding the seven sieves out of the London desk?
Sorry, can you repeat that?
Sure. We understand that Citi had seven special investment vehicles.
Oh, yeah. No, I was not involved in that.
Okay. that makes for a short conversation. When you came over to Citigroup in 2006 with Michael Raines. Did you have any understanding as to whether Citi was trying to grow its CDO business?
No. I was not aware of that. I was focusing on correlation.
That's fair.
So I was not aware of the any growth plans or otherwise on the CDO side.
Okay. How much did you make when you were hired in 2006? What was your compensation package?
My compensation package in 2006 was, I think my cash compensation was, and again from memory, I think it was around $3 million. My deferred compensation in stocks was, I think, another $2.5 million or so. Again, this is from memory. So another $2.5 million in deferred compensation.
And did that change significantly in 2007?
In 2007, I think my cash compensation was lower. I think it was $2.5 million. And I think my deferred was lower as well to be, I think it was around $2.25 million.
And in 2008?
I'm sorry, that's the time I don't really remember what happened. I don't have that number in my...
In your mind, was it staying relatively the same, or was it going up or down?
I believe it was lower than 2007.
Okay.
And I just don't remember the number. I think it would be around between $3.5 million to $4 million total compensation. I don't know. I mean, I don't remember how much was it cash and how much was it deferred in stocks. I don't remember that.
Okay. Did you have any meetings with regulators while you worked with Citi in 2006 or 2007?
Yes, I had meetings. The meetings I remember were with OCC. In 2007, and that was as part of the examination which OCC was doing in London. I was involved in the examination, from the credit correlation side in terms of, OCC coming in and examining your credit correlation business.
Are we allowed to ask questions about that, Ms. Bergel? I don't know the status.
The OCC and the Fed have waived their assertion of the bank examiner's privilege, so...
Yes. Oh, they have for this. Okay.
They have.
All right.
Okay. Can you tell me what you remember about those meetings with the OCC, Mr. Bhatia?
Yeah, the meetings with the OCC were focused on non-subprime, non-ABS business. It was focused on credit correlation. The, in credit correlation, we had gone through, and this is around before the time I joined, through a VAR approval process. VAR is value at risk, so value at risk approval process. So the meeting was a follow-up meeting to that. And it was also a follow-up meeting to, I think, in 2005, there was an OCC audit in New York. So the discussions there were mainly specific to the credit correlation business, to the ABS correlation business. I didn't represent that business. Therefore, I did not represent anything related to subprime there.
Did you have any other meetings with regulators while you worked with Citi in 2006 and 2007?
Yes, I mean, I had other meetings with, at least I recall one meeting where I recall OCC examiners in that meeting. I think that was more of, and I don't remember unfortunately it was in 2007, I don't remember when the meeting was, but just as a general, you know, market update in terms of, you know, in terms of what was happening in the market, not to discuss exact positions.
Did you, in the course of those meetings, do you recall any questions or concerns from the OCC regarding Citi's subprime exposure?
No, actually, this meeting I'm talking about, which I remember, I think was after it was around, I think, fall of 2007, where the subprime market had largely unfolded. So I think it was more of a question of, you know, reflection on the market, and reflection on our positions. That was basically the main topic there.
Do you recall at any time OCC being critical of Citigroup's risk management practices?
Well, I mean, I know that the audit of credit, the credit correlation audit, which happened in 2005, again, that was not limited to subprime, that was not limited to ABS, well, sorry, that was not including subprime or ABS correlation, you know, was critical of the credit correlation desk. So I was involved in kind of answering their concerns on that, and that's why, you know, there was a follow-on audit in 2006 on that, but I don't remember any concerns regarding that they raised regarding, you know, subprime exposures or ABS correlation while I was running that business.
Okay. And in 2006 and 2007, was the OCC critical at that time of Citi's?
I was not involved in that, so I'm not sure.
Oh, I'm sorry. Fair enough. I thought you said you were in a meeting at that point. Any other regulators other than the OCC that you met with in 2006 and 2007 at Citigroup?
I mean, I also recall, you know, a meeting with Fed, but I don't recall the content of the meeting. It was, again, I think more of a market color than discussing any positioning and so on. I don't remember the exact content of the meeting, though.
Any meetings with the FSA?
I'm trying to remember it while I was in London, whether I met with FSA or not. To be honest, I don't remember. I need to go and check back whether there were any meetings scheduled between me and the OCC. I don't remember any discussion with FSA on subprime or an ABS correlation. But I may have a meeting with them on credit correlation, which I don't recall at this stage.
Looking back at your at 2006 and 2007, and these are by way of background and explanation in the next very short line of questioning, Mr. Bhatia, and we are almost finished. One of the things that the Commission is charged with is just looking at the, what exactly caused the perfect storm, you know, business decisions that were made by institutions, factors in the market, regulation, we're looking at a lot of things. And we're not an enforcement body, by the way. We're just looking at at potential causes and contributors to the financial crisis. So one of the things we are asking everyone we talk to, and I know your time at Citi was short, but it was during a critical time, so I will ask you these questions as well, is looking back to your time at Citi from August 2006 to November of 2007, do you think you made any mistakes?
No.
Regarding the... Okay.
You're asking me as a person, right?
Yes, just in regard to the business decisions you made. And again, your time is short, so the question I know doesn't... is a little strange in your case, but from at least August of 2006... I guess you're on the other desk. Looking back, in hindsight, do you think other individuals at Citigroup that you came across and perhaps studied when you moved into the roles you moved into in 2007, do you think there were mistakes that others at Citigroup made? on in regard to the ABS-CDO business?
No, I mean, I don't think so there were any mistakes made. But, you know, I think as I talked about, I think in hindsight, it's clearly the case that we had, you know, our exposure to the sector was high.
And looking back and from lessons learned and just anything you've gathered during your time at Citigroup, can you give us any color on why Citigroup may have been more exposed than others in that area? And I know you mentioned Merrill and others, and certainly there were other market participants that were also very exposed. But, you know, there were some large market participants that were less exposed. Can you add any color on why Citi got itself in a position of more exposure?
Sure. I mean, I think as I mentioned before, the first thing was, so I mean, I look at Citi's risk in ABS, you know, in ABS CDOs. You know, we had super senior exposure, we had more junior exposure, and you know, the junior exposure or the, you know, or the warehouse or the inventory exposure was clearly from the fact that, you know, we were active and very active in the CDO business. CDO business was a fee business. You know, we made a small fee for distributing that risk. The premise was that we would not be left with any open risk. But when the market stopped, then obviously we were left with a lot of inventory positions. And as a result of that, you know, we took huge losses and we gave up, you know, all the fee we have earned over the last, whatever, probably all the fee we have earned over the last 10 years or so in the fee business. So it's clearly the case that, you know, we were relying a lot on a distribution to take us out of risk, and you know, we did not contemplate, looking back again, we did not contemplate that the distribution, you know, would stop one day. So that, I think, in hindsight, is one thing which we learned from this crisis. The second thing is, you know, the super senior position, of focusing on that for a second, you know, clearly our exposure across, you know, the two cash book and the correlation book was quite high. You know, and again, looking back, it's, you know, that exposure, you know, was oversized versus our competitors, and that exposure should have been lower. And again, in hindsight, you know, it when you look at it now, something that pays, you know, 0.25%, you know, you're looking at an upside which is not that much, right? Which is just kind of the fee you earn, but you're looking at a downside which is quite high. So looking back, it seems that it was not the right decision to have made to first of all concentrate a lot of risks in super senior and then concentrate it in something that doesn't pay you that much, right? So return on capital didn't seem to be that high. Now knowing that the capital obviously was much higher than we initially envisaged it, I mean, it was.
From the August 06 time period, you know, until the summer of 2007, do you recall any conversations in Citi just about the quality of the underlying collateral, how the RMBS and the underlying mortgages were originated, whether originating standards were not high?
No, I don't remember any conversations from, you know, as I mentioned that stage, you know, my involvement was in risk meetings. I don't remember any discussions on that.
Do you personally think that the explosion of the CDO market and contributed to the financial crisis?
I mean, I think crisis was essentially, I think, came, I don't think so the CDO was responsible for the crisis. My personal view is that, you know, CDOs did result in basically greater leverage in the system for some investors, and so they were more adversely affected by the crisis.
What about the increase in synthetic products and the ease with which leverage could be increased without increasing sort of the real underlying assets. Do you think that contributed to the financial crisis?
I don't think so it contributed to the crisis, but it did for some part, it did create a chain reaction where for some participants, you know, the losses were outsized versus the capital they had. And as a result of that, you know, there is a systemic factor which resulted in that being transmitted to other participants. But I do think the genesis and the was not CDO related. The genesis was just the macroeconomic factors or the technical factors affecting the underlying collateral.
Okay. Those questions may seem unfair to you, but I don't run across too many PhDs in the trading world. So
I look at our portfolio, and if you look at our portfolio, you know, our exposures in, for example, in synthetic space were, in CDOs, overall in notional terms, were much smaller than in cash terms. And that's because synthetic was a market which was a new market, and cash had been around for a while. So if you look at the size of exposure we had, you know, synthetic was much smaller than cash.
Because I'm so new to this, and you have more time with it, I'm going to ask you. It was one of the significant drivers on the synthetic process just that people couldn't do deals fast enough?
I think it was more customization rather than people can do deals fast enough or not. I think that's basically what I would say was the primary reason. You're right, the deals in terms of ramping up the collateral, it's easier or it's quicker to just sell protection rather than find where the bond is, the cash bond, and then buying the cash bond. So the pace is obviously, you know, the pace is different, but I think the primary reason why, you know, what is done is because of customization of risk.
Have you ever given testimony or a deposition before, Mr. Bhatia?
No.
And have you ever been involved in any litigation related to your work with Citigroup?
No.
Is there anything else that you think we should know?
No.
Would your lawyers like to add anything?
I don't think so.
Two final comments, Mr. Bhatia. One, thank you. This has been enormously helpful. These are some areas that are very new to us, unfortunately, we don't have a lot of time to figure out a lot of these things. So we really appreciate being able to go directly to somebody who does this for a living, and you've been very patient, and we appreciate that. And that comes with an apology for those things which, with more time, I would have endeavored to understand more before talking to you. So that's the first. And the second is just to reiterate what I mentioned at the beginning of the call, that while one of our missions is to hopefully make public some views on some of the contributing underlying causes of the financial crisis, our investigation work is confidential, so we would ask that you not share the fact of or substance of this interview with anyone other than your counsel.
Sure.
And that, I'm going to turn off the tape recorder with those words.